This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. Coming up, charter schools are actually increasing segregation in the inner cities, a posthumous pardon for the Scottsboro Boys, and the historic defeat of the movements led by Malcolm, King, and the Black Panther Party. But first, the public schools of Greater Los Angeles are literally crawling with police who introduce students to the criminal justice system at an early age. Ashley Franklin is with the Community Rights Campaign of the Labor Community Strategy Center. She helped write a recent report titled Black, Brown, and Overpoliced in L.A. Schools, which documents the extraordinary levels of police presence in the school system.
We have an entire school police department that has a $56 million budget, and they're designated solely for our schools, but they can also police around the community as well. But inside schools, they give out tickets to students, and the tickets can range from tardiness and truancy, which we fought against last year, as well as disturbing the peace, which could be everything from talking loudly to actually getting in a physical fight with someone else inside of the school. So in L.A., a wide range of school discipline issues that were once handled by our school administration are now more and more being handled by our school police officers. So that's the ticketing process that we see, and that's where we see the policing issue come inside of our LA schools.
And your school police force, that is the police force that's dedicated just to the schools, is actually bigger than the police departments of most cities.
Yes, that's very true. And in all honesty and fairness, we have a huge school district. And yes, the school police force is very large. But, you know, if we just look at the stats, you know, we are number one in prison spending, but, you know, 47, I think now, in education spending. So to me, when you have a police force so large with such a large dedicated budget, it makes me wonder, what are we really trying to set up our students to go into? Are we trying to set them up for success and education, or are we trying to set them up to go into prison, which is a real question that we have to ask. If we look at the citation patterns that we see, where the majority of the citations, let's be real, in the last 3 years, they gave out 38,000 citations, which has been a decrease from what they've given out a while back because we've been fighting against it, right? So we've seen a 50% decrease in citations, but yet it still isn't enough, right? They're still giving out these citations, and the majority of the people who are receiving these citations are black folks.
So there are less tickets, but they are still overwhelmingly and disproportionately black and Latino. You have an amazing statistic here. You say that black students are 29 times more likely than white students to be ticketed for disturbing the peace.
That's correct. And what we saw, even with the decrease in citations overall, black students are 5.8 times more likely to receive a citation than any other student. What we also noticed that 47% of the citations went to middle school kids and younger. So some as young as 6 years old. I mean, the majority of the citations went to 14 and 15-year-olds. So we can see that it's not just happening in the high school realm, but it's more and more seeping into our middle school realm and our elementary school. So it's, again, conditioning our students on a path which I believe is to prison.
And what kind of weight are these tickets for young people to carry around? Are they the equivalent of having a record?
The scariest part about all of this is not simply that a student received a citation, but this is the introduction to our young people to the criminal legal system. What we see, once these students receive these tickets, they then have to go to court. After they go to court, they have to pay large fines. So it's not just a burden on them, but it's also their introduction into the criminal system at such a young age.
And one of the ticketable offenses that you didn't mention is defiance, ticketing for defiance. What is defiance?
Defiance is one of those broad categories, and which is the scary part of all of this, is that it's up for interpretation. So defiance can be everything from rolling your eyes to actually verbally disagreeing not to do your work. So it's a broad category that can be defined by whomever gives out the ticket.
And so the ticketers behold black and Latino students as being defiant in ways that they don't perceive white students.
Of course, we see it with just the overall citation patterns. 94% of all citations that were given out were given to Black and Latino students, and majority of them, again, were given to Black students, Black males in particular.
How did you put pressure on the authorities to at least cut back on the level of ticketing?
We had a huge fight, a five-year fight around truancy tickets in Los Angeles. And truancy tickets are basically truancy or tardy tickets. So when students wouldn't go to school or when students were arriving late to school, so let's say school started at 8 o'clock, if they got there at 8:05, they were being greeted by officers. And mind you, it was a city law that allowed LAPD, our school police department, as well as our sheriff's department, to give students tickets for being tardy to school or not going to school. So we led a five-year fight and struggle with the city, with the school board, as well as with the school police department and LAPD to basically amend that law, which now doesn't allow students to be cited for tardiness at all, as well as for truancy tickets, the cuts back where, you know, on the third time that they receive a notice by an officer, they don't have to pay a $250 to $1,000 fine. The maximum that they can pay in their lifetime is $25, as well as it opened up these centers called workforce centers where students who weren't going to school can now be funneled into these centers where they can talk to a PSA, which is the pupil service and attendance counselor that's only there to help with attendance, getting students on the track to go to school, meaning if it's their classes, if it's bus tokens, whatever it is. So providing social services for our young people to actually get to school. So once we saw this huge victory, we saw that it was that light bulb, not only with LAUSD, but with the school police department. I think it was shining in, like, these are just discipline issues that could be handled by our school administration if we built an infrastructure of support. And so I think that this was one of those steps of building that infrastructure of support. And I think from that, they noticed other patterns of their citations, and that's where we see the 50% decrease. So it was a community-led effort that led to that 50% decrease. But again, the community-led effort hasn't ended. Again, there's still tickets for disturbing the peace, defiance, and all those other categories where students are being caught into the criminal legal system.
And you say that even many of the police resent having to act as disciplinarians in school.
Well, I haven't had that many personal interactions with the officers when talking about some of these issues, but I would only assume that at the end of the day, if we are truly thinking about young people and them graduating and them going on to college or going on to a job that pays them well, we do have to question what's the budget looking like to actually ensure that there is an infrastructure of support, meaning are there enough counselors inside the schools, teachers inside the schools to ensure that happens, or are there more police officers? And so when I think about police officers having to give out these tickets, I know that they're probably thinking about, well, what is my exact role on this campus, and what is this idea of safety? Is safety really a disturbing the peace ticket? Is safety really students coming to school tardy? Is that really a safety issue? So I think, you know, again, just as we're out questioning these things, they may be questioning them too.
Now, many of us are familiar with the term push-out, that is, institutionalized ways that are employed to actually lessen the number of Black and Latino students in schools by excessive discipline.
That's correct. Again, with these citations are a symptom of a much larger problem, which is the lack of investment, care, and love for the majority of Black and Latino students who attend LAUSD schools. So when we see this whole there not being an infrastructure, when we see the citation, when we see the over-policing, again, this is a signal to me that it is push-out. And what we say, it's pre-prison conditions. So, you know, you have officers that are giving out citations. You see that there aren't enough teachers. You see that there aren't enough counselors inside of the school. So you're creating conditions that makes it much easier for students to not go to school opposed to staying in school and actually receiving an education that can take them down a road to success.
Now, many of our listeners might assume that excessive ticketing, excessive disciplinary measures are brought against Black and Latino students in those schools that have lots of white faculty. But I've read from other reports that schools with high levels of Black faculty are also excessively disciplining kids.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I don't know the exact stats. I haven't done my research that in depth, but I do know one thing is that when we think about our school system, especially here in LA, when you have 45 people in a classroom and you may not have the best classroom management skills, even if you have the best classroom management skills, it's much easier to send that student out of the class to an officer to address issues opposed to actually trying to get to the root cause of the issues. Now, if we have smaller classroom sizes, right, I think that it would be much easier. Again, it's looking at how overall, if we look at the investment in our education system opposed to policing, that it's not adding up. And so what we see is the over-policing, which is such something is so easy where you can just push a student out, right? We see these factories, push-out factories inside of L.A.
Your report says that 70% of the tickets are given to males, but I've also read that in the Los Angeles Unified School District, the second largest category of disciplined youth are black females.
That's right. So what we're noticing and seeing as a trend is that more and more it's our black women who are receiving the tickets, and a lot of those tickets are for disturbing the peace, which is disconcerting. Male or female, we don't think that any student should be receiving these tickets at all.
Your long-term goal, of course, is to get rid of this whole school-to-prison process.
Yeah. One thing that we are demanding of our district is, number one, to end citations for middle and elementary school students, as well as to adopt an equal protection plan, which is something that the community came together and wrote, and it took maybe 6 months or so where students were at the table, and they wrote, how can we clearly delineate the role of our officers on campus? How do we build the capacity of our school administration to address school discipline issues? So those are the things that we're proposing inside of this document. We have structural proposal to overall change the system.
And what about student organizing, and how can students effectively organize against disciplinary measures when theoretically they can be charged with defiance?
That is so true. But, you know, just to be honest, our black, brown, and over police in LA schools report is a product of students. So our organization has five different school-based organizing. We call them movement-building projects, where youth are leading agendas, raising awareness, raising consciousness on their campus about the role of policing inside of schools. They're also having very deep conversations about, like, what do they envision as a way of how to address school discipline when they arise. We don't want to be blind and say that things don't arise on campus, but how do we address it in a holistic manner and get to the root cause of the issues that we're seeing on campus? So, yes, defiance is one of those fears, but I think that our youth have read their history. They understand that people like Malcolm have been defiant, but have seen real changes. And so they've been fighting back, and they continue to fight back at the different high school bases.
Ashley Franklin of the Labor Community Strategy Center in Los Angeles. In some cities, charter schools have reached such critical mass they threaten to overwhelm the public education system. Stan Karp taught high school in Paterson, New Jersey for 30 years. He's now director of the Secondary Reform Project of New Jersey's Education Law Center. Karp is also an editor at the influential publication Rethinking Schools, where he wrote a recent article titled, How Charter Schools Are Undermining the Future of Public Education. Karp says big financial interests are trying to develop a more privatized alternative to public education in the United States.
Originally, the idea of charter schools, which were developed with a lot of teacher union support, were really two things. They were going to be teacher-run schools in partnership with community institutions, and that they were going to provide models, you know, laboratories for innovation that would produce models that would help improve the public system, which, you know, has lots of room for improvement. But the original idea of charter schools has never really developed where they provided models for improvement that could be applied to the system-wide. And instead, especially in the last 10 years, it's really been transformed from this original idea of community-based educator-initiated efforts for a small number of students into nationally funded efforts by foundations, investors, and educational management companies, a lot of hedge funds, to create a parallel, more privatized school system. And it's really become a reform cover for undermining one of the most important public institutions we have, which is public schools.
It looks like a process that Wall Streeters would call making a market, that is, creating a market for a privatized parallel system.
Very much a market reform. And actually, one of the really alarming features of this is the way that investors and business interests that have been able to attach their agenda for market reform and education to the pressing needs, urgent needs of communities who have not been well served by the existing system. But the market is going to do for education what it has done for housing, what it's done for healthcare, what it's done for employment, which has reproduced opportunities for fabulous profits for a few and very unequal access for the many. So market reform does not hold out much hope for improving the problems of a public system, and instead is transferring resources and students and parents, putting their interests in a much more privatized system that is not subject to either democratic control or transparent public oversight.
So let's talk about two things. One, how are charter schools doing in educating the students who attend them? And what does the existence of this growing parallel network of charter schools do to the public schools or the conventional public schools?
Well, I think we have, you know, quite a bit of experience now, especially over the last 10 years, to demonstrate that charter schools do not provide a better educational opportunity for most students, and in many cases provide fewer outcomes that you would want to reproduce. The most reliable research on charter schools usually relies on test scores, which is a very dubious way to evaluate quality, but is one of the only comparable statistical ways that most research does. And most research is pretty well established that there is no dramatic difference in charter school achievement on standardized tests or on academic outcomes than public schools. And where there is a difference, it's almost entirely attributable to the difference in the populations being served. Systematically, charter schools serve fewer high-need students, fewer English language students, fewer of the poorest students, fewer special needs students. And one of the things that's striking about the research in charter schools is even the research that tries to show that charter schools produces better test scores or better outcomes, they never seem to be able to identify any aspect of charter school performance or pedagogy or curriculum that accounts for this. It's almost always attributable to the difference in the demographics, the difference in the population served. And that's one of the reasons it's not an approach that can be used to systematically improve public education, because it relies on systematically segregating and serving a different population. So the number one problem we have in public education is concentrated poverty and segregation. And over the course of 10 and 15 years of experience, we find that charter schools increase this segregation and this concentrated poverty. They do not reduce it.
It seems that the more charter schools can keep the more problematic cohorts out of their schools, the better they do.
Yes, absolutely. And I would direct your listeners to Bruce Baker, a researcher at Rutgers, does a really informative blog called School Finance 101, in which he has really documented, both in New Jersey, where I am, and throughout the country, how systematically, if you look at the demographics of the charter school experiments, this is where you're finding the increase in segregation, the higher attrition rates, the different populations being served. And that's one of the things that really undermines its credibility as a reform strategy for public education.
The word cherry-picking is often used when talking about charter schools. There are many ways to cherry-pick students, and one way is to cherry-pick self-selected parents, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, market mechanisms basically allocate, you know, reproduce differences that people bring to markets or to lotteries with them. Perfect example of that would be in Newark, where I am now, in which you have a growing sector of charters financed by private foundations, financed by private institutions that have left behind a more high-needs population in the Newark public schools while taking selected populations and sometimes doing a little better with them because of the effects of not concentrating 70, 80, 90% high needs, high poverty ELL students, special education students, not serving those populations, serving a different population, and then taking the results, and also then taking those students that are not succeeding in the charter system and sending them back to the public schools, where they also increase this concentration of high-need students being left behind by charter privatization.
Of course, Newark is the home base of Cory Booker, the former mayor, now senator, whose career began with his association with private schools.
Yes, and actually also the home now of the heavy investment of foundations and private individuals like Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg, who gave $100 million to support charter expansion, mostly in Newark. And now they're moving into a situation that you've seen in Denver and New Orleans, where they're beginning to take the enrollment mechanisms of these districts and trying to combine the enrollment and placement process for charter schools and public schools into one unit that effectively turns the district into a recruiter for the charter schools and reproduces the kind of selective system that in New Orleans, for example, now has almost all students going to tiers of privatized charters and having some of the highest need students and families not being able to find any public school that will take them.
Yes, that's very interesting. The defenders and proponents of charter schools some years ago said all they wanted to do was create competition for public schools. But in places like New Orleans and a growing number of other cities, it appears they want to substitute the public schools with charter systems.
Yeah, no one questions the desire of parents to find the best options for their children. And public education has not always done a good job of providing good options for all families. But it's a little bit like any other area of society. If you rely on the market and you rely on privatized interest to address those kinds of needs, you basically get a reproduction and often an expansion of the inequities that you want to really need to be addressed with public policy and more equitable approaches. One of the good examples of this, for example, would be in Wake County, North Carolina, where you had an attempt to address the inequities in Raleigh, where the schools were not having as much success dealing with concentrated poverty, by integrating them with the entire county and trying to limit the concentration of poor and high-need students to 40%. So there would be a more equitable distribution, and then you would try to improve the magnet schools, the quality of the educational programs at each of the schools to try to have equity and a dispersion and integration of high-need students in an effort to address the central problem. And they had some of the best success in the country in reducing achievement gaps and improving outcomes for high-need students. But that, too, is now being eroded by a more market approach to education, which is also not only based on moving students and resources from public to private, but it's also based on trying to create a less stable, less secure, less unionized, less experienced, and therefore less expensive professional teaching force, which is also a big part of the charter picture.
Yes, it's long been the case that many proponents of charter schools have been waging a kind of war against unionized teachers, but many now seem to be intent on deprofessionalizing the profession itself.
Yes, I think that's very true. In most places, charter teachers are less likely to be certified, less likely to have the kind of professional credentials and preparation that is required in typical public systems. You see things like Teach for America. These are programs in which people without experience in education get a five-week training course, and are actually sometimes districts are paying a finder's fee, a bonus, to Teach for America in order to provide less experienced, less prepared teachers, sending them into schools without much support, and then only getting a two-year commitment in which these teachers are much more likely to leave the profession. But at the same time, in a place like Chicago, you're closing public schools, you're firing unionized teachers or teachers with preparation and replacing them with less prepared professionals, less prepared teachers in less public schools.
And yet Teach for America has a big fan in President Obama, who talks all the time about U.S. competitiveness in education. And yet the best models in terms of results, globally speaking, are those systems that give teachers, well, lots of respect as a profession.
Yes, unfortunately, the kind of market reform and test-based reform we've seen in the last decade is very much a bipartisan project. In the last 5 years, since 2008, 2009, there have been almost 4,000 public schools, district public schools closed in the United States, while the number of charters has increased by almost 50%. So it's not a question of schools no longer being needed by students. It's changing one kind of school and one kind of teaching force for another kind of school and another kind of teaching force that is much less connected to long-term success, much less connected to the kinds of international examples you see of high achievement and good outcomes in places like Finland, where all the teachers are unionized, but also all the teachers and also the students have health care, have protection, job security, and the kinds of things that make for a well-functioning public institution.
We know from the right wing's own propaganda that one of the goals of spreading charter schools was to create a wedge between the black community specifically and teachers' unions. How successful has that been, and what kind of pushback are you seeing today?
Well, I think you've seen a lot of success in a couple of ways. One, the privatization agenda used to be tied to the voucher plans, which very explicitly took public money, gave it to private and religious schools to pay tuition, and never got a lot of traction, partially because wherever people had a chance to vote on these plans, they were defeated, and partially because the private schools and the religious schools had neither the capacity nor the interest to serve poor communities of color at the level that they need to find slots for their kids. The charter movement has been much more effective in kind of serving as the wedge you describe, kind of undermining public systems, taking larger and larger sectors of the student population until they get to a certain point where then they try to actually change, as they are now, the whole enrollment process so that districts become handmaidens, really, in their own privatization. So in a place like Newark, you've had gradually increasing the number of charter schools and the sector that goes to charter schools to where it's now about 25%. There's about almost $200 million a year that goes from the Newark public school budget to the charter school sector. This is money that is individually now controlled not by the public, but by the charter boards, the privatized charter boards, which are publicly funded but privately managed. And now with these enrollment systems, they are trying to move even more quickly to the whole what they call a portfolio or market system, where anybody who's looking for access to schools will go through a market system that will actually encourage them to move from district schools to charter schools in a way that undercuts one of the fundamental institutions we're supposed to have in the public education system.
And are we seeing signs of resistance or at least mass questioning by the community of this new regime?
Yeah, I think we're seeing it in a couple of places. You know, we saw it certainly in Chicago last year when the teachers union forged a very successful alliance with the community based on years of honest exchange by, a teacher union leadership that kind of recognized that public education was also not serving poor communities well and that needed radical reform based on equity, not based on market reform. We've seen some of the same efforts in New York, where efforts to prevent what's called the co-location of schools, where charter schools are placed in public facilities, often with unequal access to resources and technology, and that this has been extremely disruptive, and communities have fought this. And one of the reasons that Mayor Bloomberg's opposite, at least at the level of electoral politics, Bill de Blasio, was elected was because he promised to change those policies. And now we'll see if community pressure and community activism can generate changes, at least at the local level, in some of these policies which have really undermined public systems.
Stan Karp of the Education Law Center in Newark, New Jersey. The African People's Socialist Party holds its 6th Congress in St. Petersburg, Florida, December 7th through 11th. Omali Yeshitela is the party's chairman and a veteran of 5 decades of political organizing. Yeshitela says there's an urgent need to complete the unfinished political work of 2 generations to answer the question, what happened at the end of the 60s? And why is there no black mass movement worthy of the name today?
What happened is that we saw a revolution that was defeated in this country and throughout the world. And I think it's really important when we talk about what happened to the struggle in this country to contextualize it. In the 1960s, the Chinese characterized that period as one where revolution was the main trend. And you could see revolutionary struggle happening everywhere in the world, including here in the United States. And, of course, the immediate impetus for the struggle then was all of the struggles for national liberation that had happened from India to China to everywhere in the civil rights movement in this country. And it gave rise to an incredibly worldwide struggle of oppressed people to change our circumstances and our relationship to imperialism. And we met a brutal military defeat that's never really been summed up. But it resulted in things like the assassination of Lumumba in Congo in 60, 61, the overthrow of Nkrumah in Ghana, the capture, wounding, and assassination of Che Guevara in Bolivia in 1967, in the mass arrests, the assassinations of people like King and people like Malcolm here in the United States and scores of others. So you had a movement that was crushed, and one of the things that's been extremely problematic is that since there's never been a real summation of a revolution being defeated, people have allowed the passage of time alone to sort of indicate that there's been a continuum from that period to this period, and there has not been a continuum. Where there was at one time an Nkrumah who fought against neocolonialism, his overthrow meant neocolonialism now reigns supreme, not only in Ghana but much of Africa. You had a situation here, even in this country, where Malcolm X, the extraordinary proponent for black liberation struggle, and now you have a Farrakhan, and people think that's a part of the same continuum. And similarly, Martin Luther King's assassinated, and then there's Jesse Jackson. And what we're seeing is not a continuum, but rather we're seeing the consequences of defeat. When you look at a Farrakhan, you look at a Jesse Jackson, when you look at the people who replaced Nkrumah and Lumumba, that's not a continuum. We're seeing the consequences of a revolution being defeated, and that even helps to explain how people come up with the notion that you can say Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and then Obama representing a line of continuation, and what Obama represents is defeat of the revolution just as all those other forces. So the problem that we have right now is that as opposed to then when there were struggles that were defined with ends in mind, for example, the struggle for independence, the struggle for self-determination, the struggle for black liberation, today what we have instead are occasional spontaneous outbreaks that will deal with an incident such as a Trayvon Martin or other kinds of things like that, and they substitute for real kinds of revolutionary work because the back was broken of the revolution, organizations dispersed, destroyed, the members of those organizations dispersed, and we've had 2 generations of people with no examples of revolution, of struggling towards some kind of end. So even though we see occasional motion towards what ends is the question that demands an answer. So, yeah, I think that something has happened, something is happening that's better today than it was 10 years ago, than it was 5 years ago. And I think what we're seeing is a generalized struggle happening all around the world, representing itself in different ways. But certainly there's a lot of motion of peoples around the world who have determined that they're not going to live under white domination anymore, which is one of the reasons. And Obama became important as a means to try and muddy up the water and obscure the reality of a continuing white power, this time with blackface. But more and more people we are seeing are coming to understand that it's going to take more than what's happened in the past. And this is one of the things that's really exciting for us at this moment in terms of the African People's Socialist Party. Our Congress is coming up because people from around the world are looking for revolutionary transformation and have become exhausted by action that don't seem to be leading anywhere.
So it's not that self-determination and black liberation is passé and past its time. It's that there were defeats that have not been recovered from, and the task ahead is largely building from scratch.
It is. And not only defeats that have not been recovered from, but been more difficult to recover from because they have not been acknowledged. And who would acknowledge defeats? Would Jesse Jackson say, I represent the defeat of the revolution? Would Farrakhan say that I'm able now to act like an heir to Malcolm X despite the fact that Malcolm has split from me and that which I represented some time ago? Of course they won't. But they have the appearance of representing a continuation, and they have not been. So acknowledgement of the defeat is critical as well, because if you don't acknowledge defeat, then you will accept what exists today as simply a continuation of the best that we had to offer during the high tide of revolutionary struggle in this country and around the world.
Struggle against neocolonialism, against imperialism, seems at a low tide in Africa as well.
It is certainly a low tide in Africa. In fact, one might argue that in Africa, our circumstances seem worse immediately than most other places around the world. But even when you look around the world, when you see such positive motion, South America, for example, where people have talked about Venezuela and Bolivia and Ecuador and other places like that, you will also notice that there is no discussion about revolutionary transformation in any of those places. So revolution has sort of been taken off the agenda, as though no one really assumes that this system can be overturned, certainly no one that's currently in power. But I think there is a growing awakening in the base that we can identify more and more. And, of course, Africa has been, from the very beginning of the start of this capitalist development, a critical component of what Marx referred to as the primitive accumulation of capital that gave rise to capitalism itself. And now, when you see this incredible crisis of capitalism, of imperialism, you see more and more forces, certainly the old imperialist powers, and those powers on the rise, on the make, hungry forces are all zeroing in on Africa as what's necessary for their salvation and for their rise. And so you watch the French, you know, controlling something like 14 different entities that called countries and states, and actually controlling the economy and controlling the politics in those places. And you see America using proxy forces all over the continent of Africa and then contending with growing influence of China with a neocolonial, rotten, foul neocolonial. I don't know if you will find a dirtier neocolonialism any place in the world unless you look at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue than what you'll find in Africa. And so you have this apparent ossified place of oppression and extraordinary exploitation, but we are busy on the continent of Africa with the intent of trying to raise up the African workers and especially and poor peasants to struggle for a liberated Africa and African people so that Africa can enter this free that much of the world is involved in to change its relationship to imperial white power.
Yes, your party, the African People's Socialist Party, has branches in Africa who will be giving reports. I think that you're saying that just because the liberationist forces seem weak, it does not follow that imperialism is strong.
Indeed, that is the case. And that's really an interesting kind of contradiction that we are looking at today. Imperialism is glaringly weak, glaringly on the decline, imperialism as it exists today. And the traditional imperial powers are facing all kinds of threats. They're facing threats from just people who are struggling to change their relationship from Afghanistan to Iraq to Palestine, throughout the Middle East and places like that, and certainly throughout the Americas. And then the traditional imperialists are having to contend with some former colonized and semi-colonized entities such as China and India and increasingly even Brazil acting like a hungry imperialist force, especially when it comes to Africa. Even Turkey trying to invade or intervene in the traditional domain of the white imperialist power. So it is an incredible, tenuous, and volatile situation that exists in the whole world. And when you look at a situation and you see that Greece is talking about suing Germany for reparations for the Second World War, but really in defense from the austerity measures that Germany is imposing on Greece through the EU, you're looking at a crisis. So the crisis represents itself in a Greece that is facing all kinds of economic difficulties and charging that the EU is treating it like a third world country. And, you know, what do you think we are, niggers or something? And it's just an entirely volatile, unstable situation. And it's ripe for the growing leaps in consciousness of oppressed peoples everywhere who also are experiencing this crisis, but experiencing it in some different ways politically, certainly than what the imperialist powers themselves are experiencing it.
Yes, we see examples of the fact that the superpower ain't what it used to be in the United Nations General Assembly vote recently around the U.S. embargo against Cuba. The United States was absolutely and totally alone except for Israel.
Yes. In many ways, it may go down to the wire, ultimately, in that fashion, the United States and Israel going down together in a blaze of infamy. But, you know, what we've seen, even more than that, I mean, people are going to quibble about the significance of the so-called deal that the United States just made with Iran. And what was it, five different countries, and they are gloating that they've got Iran to do what they want to do around the nuclear question. But the greater thing to me is that after all these years, they now have got to have to sit down and try to negotiate something with Iran in an area of the world that they had absolute control in before, where they didn't have to negotiate anything. They just ran it the way they wanted it to be. So even where they like to show what they characterize as strength, it is, it seems to me, like more evidence of a declining imperial power, certainly in the form of the United States and Europe as well.
Yes, the accord may in fact show that the United States' policy of alliance with jihadists, such as in Syria, is in total disarray.
It's in disarray. And so you've got this really extraordinary kind of alliance between the Jewish settler state and jihadist Islamists and Saudi Arabia and the United States. And, you know, that is extraordinary. And it is going to be something that informs, and it is informing the consciousness of people everywhere, and especially people who are dominated and brutalized by these reactionary Muslim regimes, like in Saudi Arabia and in that area. So it's incredible to see Netanyahu in bed. Everyone knew that he was sleeping with the U.S. imperialists, but for this brazen, open relationship between the Jewish state and the reactionary jihadists, that is magnificent.
So this is going to be one hell of a conversation and deliberation in St. Petersburg on December 6th, 7th, and 8th.
Indeed, it is going to be. It's very important, we believe. And as we said, that Africans from throughout the world will be here, and not from as many places as we like, just in terms of money and visa problems that the United States apparently has decided a long time ago that Africans can usually come here on ships and chains, but it's hard for Africans to get visas to come into this country from the continent of Africa itself. We have representatives here from the Mexican National Liberation Movement. We had hoped to have representatives from the Romani people, you know, and as for discussion with you, I learned that the Romani may have the largest percentage of the population in prison of any group in the world. And the so-called gypsies, they are catching hell all over Europe and being killed in places like Hungary and Bulgaria and Romania on a regular basis and harassed to no end. And we really want to try to elevate that struggle to public scrutiny so people can know what's happening with the Romani people who are slandered in the same way Africans are slandered, with every crime being committed against them justified by the fact that they are who they are or who the oppressors say they are. So a lot of people are going to be here, certainly from different places around the world, and some from this country, from Bahamas, from East Africa, from West Africa, from Congo, from England, from Switzerland, Canada, various places throughout the United States. It's going to be a really important meeting.
That was Omali Yeshitela of the African People's Socialist Party. Yeshitela is also chairman of the Black is Back Coalition. Harvard professor Henry Louis Gates is the rich white corporate establishment's favorite excuse for a black intellectual. His latest project, the six-part PBS series Many Rivers to Cross, aired its last episode last week. Predictably, Gates depicted the election of President Barack Obama as the crowning achievement of 500 years of black history in North America. Bruce Dixon has this commentary.
The final installment of Dr. Henry Louis Gates's latest PBS series, Many Rivers to Cross, was nothing to write home about. It was a lazy and dishonestly drawn picture purporting to do what black scholars whoring for the establishment in the age of Obama are always trying to do, namely to paint the rise of the black misleadership class and its first black president, Barack Obama, as the logical and the inevitable outcomes of the black freedom movement of the 50s and 60s, and of what they misleadingly call the black power movement of the 60s and 70s. I call it lazy because instead of illuminating the contexts, the causes, and the consequences of social and historical forces in play like real historians are supposed to do, Gates merely spins up a series of images and vignettes connected only by superficial commentary and narration. He begins with the assassination of Dr. King, the rebellions in dozens of U.S. cities, and 5 or 6 minutes on the Black Panther Party, emphasizing armed self-defense and coolness, while entirely omitting its socialist politics and how its opposition to the horrifically bloody war in Vietnam, in which 2 or 3 million Asians died, won it lots of allies in white America and around the world. The Black Panther Party was, in fact, not a black power movement, so much as a movement of black people against capitalist and racist empire. In place of real analysis, Gates slides in a couple chummy minutes with Ron Karenga, nowadays a fellow professor whose US organization, as part of the FBI's COINTELPRO program back in the day, murdered several Panthers in cold blood. Gates and Karenga share a chuckle about how FBI boss J. Edgar Hoover really didn't mean what he said about the Panther Party being, quote, the greatest threat to the internal security of the United States, unquote. What Hoover really feared, the guy who shot Panthers, offered helpfully, was, quote, a united black front, unquote. From there, Gates slips in quick succession back to the Panthers, to Black is Beautiful, and from there to Don Cornelius' Soul Train, to affirmative action and the birth of the current corporate-oriented black elite, including his own formative experience at Yale. He solemnly reflects upon the Cosbys and how the image of upwardly mobile black life spoke to his own personal experience. Gates does not forget to remind us that most of black America remains relatively poor, over-policed, ill-housed, and generally ill-served, and even uses the term mass incarceration a good 2 or 3 dozen times. At 36 minutes into the program, he mentions Katrina, but the only analysis offered is Kanye West's comment on how George Bush don't like black people. From there, Gates segues to Barack Obama's visit to Katrina evacuees at the Houston Astrodome and the tears which many shed at his inauguration. A real historian, noting the real status of black power at the Katrina juncture, might have pointed out that Democrats, including the numerous and powerful Congressional Black Caucus, refused to convene hearings on Katrina for fear of Democrats being labeled the Black Folks Party going into the 2006 elections. But Gates is not laboring under that burden. Skip Gates doesn't want to teach us 52 minutes of history. That's not his job. His job is to justify the glittering careers of people like himself and his class and the first black president who are somehow supposed to represent the oppressed, even as they remain oppressed. His job is to proclaim that he and his ilk are the pinnacles of black achievement, the fruits of our people's long struggle, the aim of and the end of the long march of black history, or something very like it.
Bruce Dixon, managing editor of Black Agenda Report. Four generations ago, the state of Alabama tried to execute 9 innocent black men who are now long dead. America's best-known political prisoner, Mumia Abu-Jamal, asked the question, what about justice for the living?
Scottsboro boys, Alabama, 80 years after its racist persecution of 9 black men and teens, known collectively as the Scottsboro Boys, for trumped-up charges of rape, has posthumously pardoned the men, finally clearing their names. Alabama's governor, Robert Bentley, said, "Today, the Scottsboro Boys have finally received justice. Hooray. Huzzah." The Scottsboro Nine were, all but the youngest, sentenced to death by all-white juries for a rape that never happened back in the 1930s. All of them are now dead. Nearly a century after their railroading, and a pardon is justice. It made me think of the Move 9, members of the Move organization entering their 35th year for a crime that few seriously think they are guilty of. In 2058, will a future governor declare them pardoned and grant them symbolic justice? Justice delayed is still justice denied.
The most ridiculous actor in the fictitious U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan is not President Hamid Karzai, the hustler the U.S. installed as its puppet after the American invasion in 2001. The real clowns in this charade are those Americans that pretend to believe President Obama when he says the U.S. war in Afghanistan will end on the last day of next year. Obama, of course, is lying through his teeth. The United States and its NATO allies plan to keep 10 to 16,000 troops in the country, occupying 9 bases, some of them set aside for exclusive American use, and would remain there at least 10 years through 2024. Shamelessly, Obama claims these troops, including thousands from the Special Operations Killer Elite, will have no combat role. It's the same lie President Kennedy told in 1963 when he called the 16,000 U.S. troops then stationed in Vietnam advisors, and the same bald-faced deception that Obama himself tried to pull off unsuccessfully in Iraq, until the Iraqis kicked the Americans out. Barack Obama has arrogated to himself the right to redefine the very meaning of war, having 2 years ago declared that the 7-month U.S. bombing campaign against Libya was not really a war at all because no Americans were killed. In Afghanistan, Obama waves his semantic magic wand to transform the past 12 years of war into 10 more years of not war, simply by changing the nomenclature. This is hucksterism from hell. If there was a devil, he'd be laughing his butt off at Susan Rice, Obama's national security advisor and raving banshee of war, whose assignment is to pretend that the U.S. might choose the so-called zero option if President Karzai doesn't immediately sign away his country to the Americans for the next 10 years. By zero option, Washington means it might just pick up its killer soldiers and weapons and leave Afghanistan. But that is an empty bluff. Since when has the U.S. voluntarily left any place it has forcibly occupied? There is zero chance of a zero option. But I am reminded of the events in 1963 Vietnam, when the Vietnamese president, Ngo Dinh Diem, and his brother were overthrown and executed in a U.S.-backed coup. Sending the homicidal Susan Rice to get in President Karzai's face is definitely some kind of threat. Far from ending U.S. imperial wars, Barack Obama has expanded the theaters of armed conflict. He tried to keep U.S. troops in Iraq, but the Iraqis insisted on the withdrawal terms and timetable they'd negotiated with President George Bush. Iraq is now paying a heavy price, as the U.S. and its allies arm Iraqi al-Qaeda and other jihadist elements fighting to overthrow the government of neighboring Syria. These U.S.-backed jihadists, the same ones the Americans fought against in Iraq for 8 years, now wage war against Shiites on both sides of the border. If there is any hope for an eventual peace in the region, it is that Washington might finally begin to understand that it can no longer control events through brute force or by using jihadists as surrogates in the Middle East and South Asia. Maybe that's why the Americans have tried to strike a deal with Iran. Maybe President Karzai thinks the winds of change will be sweeping through his neighborhood soon, and he doesn't want to go out like the puppet he came in.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda Television. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Heather Content.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.